It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This time last year, nearly the entire state was covered in some level of drought conditions.
Today, the U.S. Drought Monitor reports the state is entirely drought-free, and parts of the state have seen higher than average rainfall and even floods.
How are these shifting weather conditions affecting Wisconsin farmers? We've got two farmers with us for a look at last year's drought, this year's wet weather. Sarah Lloyd is a farmer in Columbia County and research fellow at the Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Great to be here.
And Dick Cates is co-owner of the Cates Family Farm in Spring Green. Dick, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
Sarah, crops are a big part of your farm. What has the wet weather done for you so far this year?
Yeah, well, we run about 1,000 acres. We're three families in our farm, and we've been sort of spared from the huge deluges, but it's definitely challenging. It's challenging to get crops into the ground and then try to get like first crop payoff because it's so wet. And I know that our friends up in North Central, up by Wausau, they're even worse off. They've just had so much rain. It's almost impossible to farm.
And Dick, your main line is pasture-based beef cattle. Does wet weather help or hinder you? Has it been a bad year so far?
Yes, thanks for asking. Yes, we've had flooding. We have a class one trout stream that runs through our farm. And it certainly has flooded. But when you have a perennialized landscape, in other words, permanent grass, no soil leaves. That soil is held in place and the water runs clear. And we are able to maintain just fine with a lot of water. We lose some fencing, but it's all portable. We put that back up. So it's very fortunate.
And Dick, how about the dry weather last year? You weren't quite in the worst of it, I think, but you were pretty close to the border, if I'm reading the map right, of the hardest hit drought area in the state last year.
Yeah, it certainly was very dry into the middle of the summer. And once again, if you leave your grass long and don't take it down short like a lawnmower would do it. Leave those cattle in just short and move them every day to a new pasture. Your grass stays long and your soil stays moist and continues to grow grass. So it's a matter of keeping the ground covered and then managing that grass. And we made it through quite well last year in the drought.
And Sarah, how about you and last year's dry weather?
Yes, we definitely experienced issues with, you know, reduced yields in corn and alfalfa hay because of the dry weather. And I think what Dick is bringing up is, you know, in this increased volatility that we're seeing in the like super dry and then super wet, is we have to figure out ways of setting up cropping and production systems on our farms that have more resiliency. So maybe a better mix of crops, like Dick said, putting in well-managed continuous pasture, continuous living cover is a way of buffering farmers and farm families from this stress of the volatility that we're starting to see now more than ever because of climate change.
And Sarah, you mentioned volatility twice there, and that's what I wanted to ask about. If we've got a year of drought, a year of rainfall, and it's more complicated than that even, it depends on when the rain comes. Are you, Sarah, hearing a lot of other farmers talking about, okay, how can we be resilient? How can we have a plan in place that can account for, hey, it might be a year of drought, or it might be a year of near floods?
Yeah, people definitely are talking about it because our livelihoods are at stake and the stress is just really intense for farm families. So, you know, thinking of these diversified systems, how can we support ourselves and our neighbors to take the risk to move into new systems? Because what we've done over the last 50 years is people have become really specialized in like what they're farming. And then that leads to like this sort of all or nothing proposal. So if we can support people, we have, you know, crop insurance. There's a lot of money right now from the federal government coming down to the states and the counties to like support people as they think out like pasture plans or these sort of cover cropping and pasture and waterways. You know, how do we support people? Because it's a risk to change your system. But we need to put a better safety net under people. And so we need to look to our friends at the county and at the state agencies that have the technical support that can help farmers do that.
And Dick, I was looking at the Cates Family Farm website. You've had, it looks like, a long interest in conservation practices. You've already mentioned a couple things you're doing. What kind of things do you do planning for the long term to say, hey, we're going to have good pasture. We're going to have good conditions for our beef cattle, come rain or no rain.
Yes. And I mentioned them basically. It's important to have a system that mimics the way the bison moved across the grasslands, move them every day, and don't let them take that grass down too short, because if you have long grass, it stops the raindrops from hitting the soil and moving soil when you have a lot of rain, or it keeps the soil moist during dry periods. In fact, we've done a measurement where bare ground would be 20 degrees warmer than grass, than soil under 4 inches of grass in a hot, dry day. And, you know, some folks they're not going to want to graze their cattle the way we do, but putting more grass in, I have a very good friend who has moved some of their highly erodible land back into permanent grass because it holds soil in place effectively. Remember, this used to be oak savanna or grassland prior to European settlement. So it's what kept this land healthy for millennia.
So with this rotation, moving cattle from place to place, you mentioned some people don't want to do it. Is it because it's a little more labor intensive? You have to get the herd to a different spot every day?
Yeah, some people may not want to graze their cattle at all. They may want to keep them in a cool environment, but putting grass in will keep the soil in place in just a miraculous way. Managed grazing is a little more time intensive than just putting cattle out and not managing them, but it's much more responsible from our perspective, and we've been doing it 37 years. First year was the drought in 88, and that helped us get through that year. It's the responsible and the way to take care of our ecosystem and our public resources, which is our trout streams and our precious soil.
We've got two Wisconsin farmers with us, Dick Cates, co-owner of the Cates Family Farm in Spring Green, Sarah Lloyd, farmer in Columbia County, talking about resilience, planning for wet weather like this year, dry weather like this year, with conservation in mind. Sarah, let's talk about stress now, not on the ecosystem, but on the farmers themselves. We know farming, a stressful line of work, and then this weather, obviously farmers have no control over that. Can you talk about mental health in Wisconsin farmers?
Yes. I mean, I think the stress on farmers is intense right now. We have these very long situations of low prices. So, you know, my family actually up until about 7 weeks ago was dairy farming. After 100 years of dairy farming, our family finally said, look, something's got to give. It's too stressful. We're losing money. And so I think along with these systems, like out on the land, these ecological systems of farming, we have to think about the economic systems. You know, I talked about like kind of getting a safety net under people in the form of like crop insurance or forage insurance, or maybe it's a margin protection so that you know you're going to make a certain amount on your crop. These are all tools that we have in our toolbox. But we also need to think about like, why can't I know that I'm going to be able to cover my cost of production and have a reasonable return for my my business and my family. And so that's the thing where we, you know, we need more support for good, fair prices for farmers. And the other part of that, when stress comes to mind, is that, you know, I need health insurance as a farmer. You know, I work off farm particularly to bring health insurance back to my farm family. And so, you know, what other things can we do for our families and our households that can allow us to just not feel so at the edge of the cliff? And so anything with economic safety nets is super important.
And Dick, in our last minute or so, anything along those lines that would help make life a little more predictable on the Cates family farm?
Well, I think the health insurance is very big. It just simply doesn't make any sense that independent business owners, farmers in our case, can't get health insurance similar to someone who works in a corporate structure or for the state. But I'll say that in terms of the pricing, my family has been through everything that Sarah is talking about. For years, I ran 800 head of cattle because I was trying to make up where there's no margin with volume. And I worked myself to death. When my wife suggested I sell my own product and we sell it under our own name, it worked. And that was 30 years ago. Our son runs our business now. We sell everything under our own name, and we're down to 100 cattle. So it's much, farmers have some control of prices if we take charge of selling our products.
We'll leave it there. Dick, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
Sarah Lloyd is a farmer in Columbia County. Dick Cates is co-owner of the Cates Family Farm in Spring Green. We've been talking about the impact of changing weather on farming and well-being of farmers in general. You can join in. Farmers out there, how has the drought last year, the wet weather and flooding this year affected you and your operation? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, there was a nationwide jump in pedestrian fatalities after the pandemic started. Find out how a Wisconsin community is working to make streets safer for walking. That's coming up here on WPR News.
Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In November, around 3 million Wisconsin voters will cast ballots in yet another election that could decide the future of the country. But a much smaller group of people keep the whole system running, Wisconsin's county and municipal clerks.
Since 2020, they've had to juggle changing election laws, conspiracy theories, even harassment. But as Anya Van Wagtendonk reports, Wisconsin clerks say they're up for the challenge.
This will be Anastasia Gonstead's first time administering a presidential election.
I have my absentee envelopes. They changed this year. They've got varying ones. So you have your standard mailers, the inner.
She's been the clerk in Mayville and Jackson, Wisconsin, since she got into the profession just a year and a half ago. That makes her one of 1,850 municipal clerks who do all kinds of things for their communities, like take minutes at sparsely attended town meetings or process licensing.
We just got done with liquor licensing season, which is huge.
Clerks also administer Wisconsin's elections. That means, especially since 2020, these nonpartisan civil servants are the face of a system under constant scrutiny and in constant flux. Like right now, there's a pending lawsuit about whether absentee ballot drop boxes are legal. If those are reinstated, it'll be up to clerks to figure out how to get them reinstalled. Gonstead says the whole thing is a juggling act.
We've constantly got laws changing, and we're always readapting. Every election brings something new to the forefront.
Clerks have been getting ready for the upcoming August primary and November election for months. They train poll workers, organize absentee ballots, and set up security plans. At the end of election night, they verify and post the results. These are often mundane tasks performed according to state and federal law. But in a swing state where four of the last six presidential contests have been decided by less than a percentage point, everything gets scrutinized. Barry Burden directs the Election Research Center at UW-Madison. He says Wisconsin's importance puts the spotlight on clerks.
An error, a small mistake or a delay caused by a clerk can lead to suspicion or misinformation or even conspiracies about something that's going wrong in the election.
Those conspiracies have made the job more stressful since 2020, when President Joe Biden defeated former President Donald Trump. Trump falsely asserted he won the race, pushing discredited allegations that fraud was to blame. Harassment and threats against election workers across the country escalated after that election. In other states, officials have reported being stalked and doxxed and receiving death threats. Scott McDonnell is the Dane County clerk. He said nothing in Wisconsin has reached that level, but
it's the kind of thing that says, like, I could make more at Costco.
McDonnell describes the situation in Wisconsin as more, quote, mundane harassment, and it's coincided with a lot of turnover. About 40% of county clerks will be handling their first presidential election this year. There isn't similar data for municipal clerks, but plenty are in the same situation. Down the road from Anastasia Gonstead, in Addison, Wisconsin, Wendy Fairbanks became a clerk in 2021. She said she sometimes hears concerns about the use of absentee ballots. In Washington County, there are public listening sessions. Sometimes, she says, voters bring in conspiracy theories about fraud. But Fairbanks said now that she knows the process, she can assure people that everything's above board.
There's so much controversy in society these days, and we just want people to be at ease knowing that, you know, their votes count and that it's going to be accurate.
Fairbanks concedes that running elections is stressful, but she says once people can come in and talk to their neighbors, including their clerks, they're pretty confident in the process. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Eight Wisconsin communities have received federal funding totaling more than $11 million to boost pedestrian safety.
Pedestrian deaths declined nationwide last year after hitting a 40-year high in 2022, according to a new report from the Governor's Highway Safety Association. But the numbers are still much higher than before the pandemic.
In 2023, just over 7,300 people were struck and killed by vehicles in the U.S. The number in 2022 was just over 7,500. Wisconsin also saw a big jump in pedestrian deaths during the pandemic.
The pedestrian safety money was granted to communities including River Falls, Chippewa County, and the Menominee Indian Tribe, along with Madison and Milwaukee. The funding comes from the Transportation Department's Safe Streets and Roads for All program.
Sheboygan received $200,000 to fund a study of heavily trafficked corridors in the city.
Hina Batt is a transportation planner for the Bay Lake Regional Planning Commission, which works with local governments in northeastern Wisconsin, including the city of Sheboygan. Hina, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Let's start with this federal money coming to Sheboygan for a study of highly trafficked places in the city. Can you tell us a little more about what you're looking into?
Yes, so the city of Sheboygan applied for a federal discretionary grant. So I'll just talk a little bit about the grant. It's called Safe Streets and Roads for All. So as a result of the bipartisan infrastructure law, this grant, this program was appropriated about $5 billion in over 5 years. So the program started in 2022 and it's going to go through 2026.
And then how long does it take for something like this to give some results where a community can start to take action?
So the award was announced in December and it's already been about 6-7 months that they just signed a contract. So it's already been 6 months before even the city could start working on it. And now the city is in the process of developing RFP, so reference proposal, to hire a consultant to help them with this. since it, we want the expert to work on it. So they're going to come in. It will probably take some time from 12 to 18 months, I would say. And during this period, the city is planning on having people involved in these activities, have them listen to the people, what their issues are, what they think. There needs to be changes in which areas and things like those. And then they are also planning on having some demonstration activities, which would involve pop-up events, like maybe there's a street or a lane that has two lanes. And then maybe we want to shorten it to only one lane and see how it works and things like those. So that would be really exciting to see firsthand what impacts we can see before having any implementation, I would say, so that we can save some money and see how it impacts and get people on board even.
Now, what's prompting this in part, this funding, is that especially in the early days of COVID, we saw this big jump in pedestrian deaths around the country. Other road accidents seem to go up, a lot of big problems there. But from one community to the next, the solutions might be different. Now, you work with the city of Sheboygan, but also some surrounding communities, Kohler, some towns there. In those different communities, what do you hear about as some of the biggest safety concerns?
I had an extensive survey out there last year. We did some outreach events at the farmers market to learn from what people have to say. And we learned that there has been some hot spots in the areas where there is more crashes happening. And actually, I was just doing some analysis of the, so in the last 5 years, from 2018 to 2022, within this metropolitan area, there has been 6 pedestrian fatalities and 1 bicycle fatality, which is a lot. It has increased from the previous years. And the topmost reason for that is the driver failing to yield to the pedestrian at a crosswalk or an intersection, or where there is even signed intersection, not just unsigned. So there are multiple reasons. And as you said, there are different recommendations that we can provide. It's not one size fits all solution. There's always, so we want to look into specific issues and then provide recommendations for those specific issues and not have a generalized plan out there, which might or might not work in those situations.
Yeah, when I hear about deaths caused by drivers not yielding to pedestrians or bicyclists, it seems like I hear two different solutions. One is we need to teach drivers to be better drivers. The other is we need to design roadways to increase visibility or lower the speed in the first place that cars are going down roads, build it so that it's safer for pedestrians and bicyclists. Do you see solutions on either side of that?
I would say all of those things are correct. We need everything. So there's not just educating the drivers, but also educating the pedestrians to kind of make sure that they are not walking into the street. Because the second most reason of the fatality is pedestrians running onto the road or not looking at the traffic incoming and just jaywalking. So it's not just one solution to any of these things. It's multiple reasons as well as multiple solutions. As you mentioned, we need to improve the infrastructure for sure. We need to have curb cuts at the places. We need to have a bump out at the intersection where there is less area where pedestrians can walk or cross the road, so that way they are less exposed to the traffic. Then there is places to improve the lighting, make it easier for the drivers to see the pedestrians and for the pedestrians to see the drivers, and kind of make sure that they are safe to be stepping into the road while they're crossing as well. And then there's always the question of education, because a lot of it's kind of is a different thing. When you talk about education, you not only want to educate the drivers, but also people. So I would say it's everything together. Maybe there are multiple solutions. You can raise the crosswalk so that it's more visible to the drivers as well. So yeah, we look into all these solutions and always try to make sure that we are providing solution which is also sustainable.
One thing that surprised me, Hina, you let us know that in your work, you found that there are a lot of bicycle and pedestrian accidents happening in parking lots. You know, I think streets, usually, of course. What is going on in parking lots, and is that a venue where we can make things safer?
Yes. So parking lots have been an issue for a while now. It's not so much for fatalities, mm-hmm. for sure, but a lot
slower
of
speeds, right? Yeah.
Yes. For a lot of people, just sometimes you just bump into someone while you're backing up your car or something. And the thing with the parking lots is parking lots are designed for cars. all you see is a huge concrete area where you can just drive up, park your car. But how are you going to get out and walk to the store? That's always been an issue, and that hasn't been a priority till date to prioritize people after they get out of their car, because all the trips starts by walking, basically. So you need to have those infrastructure in the parking lots. And most of the times, that's the issue with poor lighting in the parking lot at night. During the day, there's a lot of people going in, coming out, and a lot of cars going in, coming out. And sometimes it's hard to see the people walking or people on a person on a bike or something like that.
Hina Bhatt is with us, transportation planner for the Bay Lake Regional Planning Commission, which works in local governments in Sheboygan and surrounding communities. Hina, when we think transportation planning, I think we're mostly thinking about cars. But hold on, you're working on, as you mentioned, a bicycle and pedestrian master plan for the Bay Lakes region in Sheboygan and the surrounding area. Tell us a little bit about the kind of things you're working on.
So we just started working on this plan because I heard actually a lot from people. We have, so as a metropolitan planning organization, we have our short-range plans, long-range plans, and we always have public hearing. We have open houses. And I've been listening to people where they are like, oh, why aren't we doing something for a bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure? Like, we always have recommendations, but it's more generalized, as we were talking earlier. It's nothing specific to a specific issue. So I thought, okay, let's focus on specifically bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure. Learn about what's going on, what are the issues there, learn about the specific things. And now we are working into identifying. We are at a place where we are working into identifying the major issues and then providing for each and every issue, providing a recommendation specifically for that area. We are also looking into at the street and maybe giving some short-term solutions, and then as well as giving some long-term solutions of maybe decreasing the lane of the width of the lane and then adding a bike lane or even a protected bike lane and things like those to be able to help the drivers not speed, because sometimes speeding depends also on the width of the road. If your road looks wider, you feel like you're on a highway and you try to speed more. But if it looks narrower and if there are more urban scapes around you, you automatically slow down. It's just something you do subconsciously. I'm sorry. So yeah, those are the things we are looking into currently. And I feel like this is going to help a lot. And we have a good community in Sheboygan who are really supporting active transportation improvements and want to see active transportation infrastructure get better. They already have good infrastructure there, but they want to make it better. They want to make it better for even the kids to ride their bikes around.
Now, how about biking between communities? Are there safe ways to say, if I'm in downtown Sheboygan, I want to go to a museum in Kohler or a golf course in Kohler or Sheboygan Falls? Can I do that by bike?
Yes, there are a couple of trails that you can take to go all the way to the west side of Sheboygan County, actually, even. And then there are some trails where you can take to Kohler and Sheboygan Falls. And then we are looking into some trails to connect the north and south side of the city of Sheboygan. There are trails within the city, but we are looking into something that would connect, let's say, Howard's Grove or something in the south side. So that is something that we are also looking, like a bigger picture, let's say. The things I was talking about earlier was the small issues, but we also have to look at the bigger picture of how do you connect all these places. It's not just area where people want to travel within the city, but also we have a person who is in our task force who travels to Kohler to his work by his bike, so which is great. But there are some issues where he feels unsafe on the street at certain areas, which we have to look into.
What are some of the areas in making that kind of commute that you're seeing as potential trouble points for bicyclists, where if you clear those bottlenecks, more people would feel comfortable biking?
There are some things where, for example, crossing a street somewhere where you have to wait for long signals to get green for the bicyclist or pedestrians to cross those roads. Now, when you're in car, it's not a big deal, but when you're on a bike or walking, the weather effects and things like those. So that kind of deters people from walking or biking, I would say. And then if you, for example, if you work on reducing that waiting time for them, that would help people to be like, oh, that's not a long wait. I can wait for, let's say, X and X seconds and then just go walk since my signal will be green. And then there are some issues around, for example, it's not a protected bike lane or there are no sidewalks. Where are you going to walk? You have to walk on the road then, which is absolutely unsafe for people to do that. So those are some things, even closing little gaps, which sometimes it's hard to see, would help, would just goes a long way to have people transfer their thing from taking their car to walking or biking.
Now, one big question out there, coming back to something I brought up earlier, pedestrian deaths went up in the United States along with the pandemic. Same, you said you saw an increase in your region there. Thankfully, still fairly small numbers, but up. Do you have thoughts on this mystery of why the pandemic led to more pedestrian deaths?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. I have been researching and I've been talking to other planners and there's no one answer to that cause. I feel like there's multiple things that goes into place. People have become a little bit more impatient or distracted while walking or driving or biking. There's issues with people speeding up. That has been one of the issues that we have been looking at after the pandemic happened. And there's no reason, like there's nothing that we can pinpoint on why that happened, but there's a lot of things that goes into place, I would say. But one of the reasons is the drivers or even driving under the influence is also a big reason around Wisconsin for some crashes that happens. But yeah, it's a mystery to me why after the pandemic, this has increased, to be honest.
Hina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was great chatting with you.
Hina Abad is a transportation planner for the Bay Lake Regional Planning Commission, which works with local governments in northeastern Wisconsin. Want to hear from you. What could you do to make pedestrians safer in your part of the state? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a regional orchestra for young musicians in southern Wisconsin has a new facility in Madison.
Our space needs are dramatic. We have 5 different orchestras, ranging in size from about 60 to over 100.
How to meet the needs of young musicians, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are hearing the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestra's Pontrum Piano Quartet performing the first movement of Brahms' Piano Quartet No. 1 in G minor on WPR Music's Midday Classics. That was back in April.
After 58 years of providing music education to youth in South Central Wisconsin, the orchestra now has its own building in Madison. And the new facility allows for more opportunities to reach young people who don't come from musical backgrounds or from families with the means to afford lessons.
Kyle Knox is music director and youth orchestra conductor at the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. Kyle, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You've called this new facility a building that is unique in the United States. What makes it so special?
Well, I think what you see around town and in various places you could go around the country, there's lots of concert halls, places where we, you know, can do musicals and opera and orchestra performances, things like that, things that are really meant for public consumption, public facing kinds of rooms. But what we don't have lots of in general, and certainly here in town, is like great elite rehearsal space, places that have amazing acoustics and have the unique properties that rehearsals require, meaning the right kind of meet the space needs of large ensembles and small ensembles that are acoustically superior, that have meeting spaces and common spaces for families and communities to get together. So it was really solving that part of the performance problem, not so much the being on stage part. We have lots of great stages. It's really the rehearsal space element that this building was designed around.
This rehearsal space element, capable of holding 100-piece orchestras, from what I understand. These are large spaces. What has that allowed you to do?
Well, the needs of a youth orchestra are kind of very specific, which is, by the way, is one of the reasons why I use the word unique. This building, not a lot of youth orchestras have buildings, because our space needs are dramatic. We have, in Weiss's case, we have 5 different orchestras ranging in size from about 60 to over 100. So these are large ensembles, and they need to be in big, cavernous kinds of rooms that have great acoustics, that have a lot of floor area, that have some observation space. But we need a lot of them all at the same time, because the Weiss model is that it's sort of a busy beehive. So we're all meeting at once. So you need more than one large room. But then you also need these kinds of breakout rooms where you can have sectionals and master classes and places where you can have like lower student to teacher ratios. And so that combination of things makes but we only need it, for the whole orchestra experience. It's very busy on the weekends. And then we have other programming that happens during the week. But the large ensemble stuff really happens over a 2-day period. And so it's difficult having space. It's difficult finding space that really meets those very specific demands. And so what this building allows us to do uniquely is it allows us to run our program and to expand and to do new things and to schedule more flexibly based on the needs of our families, to reach new communities, to just continue doing what we do on an excellent level and to imagine new possibilities.
And your building has an instrument repair shop, from what I understand, as well. It has a library. Can you talk a little bit about having these types of elements under one roof?
Sure. Well, the library story is kind of funny. I started in 2018 here. But for decades preceding that, we had all of our entire music collection. If you imagine an orchestra, we have a chamber music program. So we have thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces. If you have a Tchaikovsky symphony, you have like 20 parts that are all in some giant binder, the flute parts, the violin parts, they're bowed, it's all kinds of very specific stuff for endless amounts of chamber music, just shelves and shelves of this stuff. But it was all offsite because we were in the basement of the humanities building at UW, and there was no room to store our large collection. And so it was like offsite at a storage facility. And we literally needed to, I would call the librarian and say, hey, I'd like to look at the Boeings for Tchaikovsky 4th Symphony, whatever. And, he'd get back to me and say, okay, that'll be about 3 days. We had to pay every time we wanted to access the collection,
wow,
just to go and look for things. And, there's a cost element there, but it's mostly just very cumbersome. And, if you show up at rehearsal.
You had to make a trek.
And we had kids show up on a Saturday for orchestra rehearsal, they'd forget their music at home. So you had to have copies. You didn't have them on site, so you'd have to make sure all that stuff was accounted for from the storage. So yeah, needless to say, having all of that stuff in a room upstairs has facilitates our process. And those little details add up to make a much simpler and smoother rehearsal process, especially when you're dealing with young people.
Oh, it must be a whole new world. Just to have these types of amenities.
It is. Yeah. And the instrument repair space, we have a lot of kids at Weiss own their own instruments or rent them themselves, and they take lessons and they bring them. But things go wrong even with their own instruments. And sometimes you have to get a wrench out and like sort of turn a pad that holds a key or a key that holds a pad so that it seals a tone hole so that they can play that low E. That kind of stuff does happen in real time, believe it or not, on a Saturday. But we also own lots of instruments. We lend out instruments to our music makers program. A lot of those kids are playing Weiss owned string instruments. And for the wind and brass players, there's auxiliary instruments like English horn and alto flute, bass clarinet. Those are instruments that are related to their principal instrument, let's say an oboe or a flute, but different. And younger players tend to not have made that kind of an investment in owning an English horn. So mm-hmm. Weiss plays music that includes English horn, so you have to provide one. And so we own instruments, and they get knocked around a little bit, so we have to be able to repair them. So yeah, we can do all that in-house.
You said music makers, and I want to talk about this program that provides instruments and instruction to students regardless of their playing ability. Who gets to participate in this program?
Well, anyone who contacts us is eligible, of course. Really, the idea is it's a hugely subsidized program. So some people pay more than others, but there are many people who pay very little. And the idea really is that that cost cannot be a barrier. I mean, you know, studying music, it's an expensive endeavor. What it requires, in addition to ideally being in some kind of a school program, a band or an orchestra program, is that you have to rent an instrument or own an instrument. You need to have the resources to get private lessons. That's really where the progress is made. And so a lot of the kids historically, before we took over Music Makers, would show up sort of already ready to go. I mean, we have younger kids, we have older, we have more advanced kids. You know, we have a whole range of different people in our orchestras, our five different orchestras. But that was sort of a common theme, was that people showed up already having found a teacher, already having acquired an instrument, et cetera. And the Music Makers piece is really for the population of people who maybe don't have those things yet. They don't know teachers. Maybe they can't afford those kinds of things in some cases. Mm-hmm. And so Music Makers was really designed as a place where it's sort of a soup to nuts music education. Rather than kids coming to us auditioning into an orchestra, we're actually very often starting kids from their very first lesson. Like, this is how you take the violin out of the case. Wow. These are the four strings of the violin. These are, you know, from the beginning, and they get lessons, they get an instrument, they get all their music, they get group classes. And many of those kids make their way auditioning into our orchestras. In fact, this year, I think we have 15 different Music Makers kids who audition into the five WISO orchestras. It's incredible. It's an incredible program. It's run by a fabulous team led by Rhea Hodgson, who's amazing. And it's just a great community of over 100 people who love this program.
It seems like you've also been able to convey that youth symphonies aren't just for kids from privileged backgrounds, and that it's not just for kids coming from privileged families to be able to be part of this.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think a more fundamental thing could be said on that subject, which is this is kind of a cliche, you know, but music, really, the arts really are for everyone's enrichment. Everyone has access to this stuff in spiritually, I would say, and just the amazing impact that the arts and music can have on a person's life and just the enrichment of their life. That is just true across the board. But to your point, accessing those things is a different thing. You know, you can listen to music on the radio, you can love music, but to actually learn to play music, it works different muscles. It develops your mind in a different kind of way. And that's where that part, being able to access those kinds of experiences, actually making music, is where the privilege has often come in just the way the world is, economically and otherwise.
We're talking with Kyle Knox, music director and youth orchestra conductor at the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras, looking at the new performance space in Madison and the opportunities for area youth. And I'm wondering, do you still have to deal with waiting lists, or are there areas where you still can't fill a need that you're seeing?
Well, certainly in the Music Makers department, we have a waiting list. That's really mostly, I mean, I guess I could just speak openly about this, but it's mostly just a fundraising issue. Like, we have a big budget and we have a fantastic team who raises money to support what we do. And I should also say, as an aside, that about 30% of, let's say, the typical orchestra student, the kid who auditions into the youth orchestra, about 30% of their total WISO experience is covered by their tuition. The remaining 70%, might be over 70%, is covered by, grant writing, through philanthropy, through fundraising, we have an endowment that we draw from, and that's really central to the WISO philosophy, is just keeping this relatively affordable. We've done the math. So for an orchestra kid, it's under $10 an hour to be part of this over the course of the year. So it's that I will just say that as a first move. That said, the Music Makers program, pound for pound, is actually much more expensive, because you're, generally speaking, the tuition tends to be much lower. And the services are actually much greater, because you're providing lessons and music and an instrument and group classes and all of those kinds of things. So the ratios are actually a little bit more difficult. So we have really met that challenge from a fundraising standpoint. But In terms of where there's room for growth in every element of what we do at WISO, but in the music makers domain, that really we could do more. We could reach more people, but it's just a matter of finding a way to generate that kind of philanthropy and that kind of, you know, grant funding that can really support reaching another 100 kids, another 200. I mean, there's lots of people who need the service.
Well, looking at the financial aspect of this, how do you envision the financial sustainability of this space? It's a very large space. You're trying to keep up a huge facility with expanded programs. Is that a challenge?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. We, you know, and you try to think 10 steps ahead when you're planning a project like this. Mm. And you try to think of every possibility and all the possible costs, but you don't actually fully understand those things until you've lived in the space and walked the hallways and seen what it costs to heat it and to cool it and to keep it clean and to repair, you know, this or that little thing that happened inevitably. And so I'd say we're still trying to figure that out, but we, you know, our estimations have not been wildly off, let me put it that way. But it will require a new funding model for WISO. We would never expect that to come on the backs of our members. That is like that, like I said, that's a core part of the WISO philosophy, is making this relatively inexpensive and available to people. So that just means we need to, like, you know, get more creative in how to generate revenue, if that's rentals, other letting outside groups use the space for different purposes. If it's of course more fundraising, it's probably all of the above. And we're still trying to really figure that out.
I want to ask you about the mental health of the young people you're working with, because we've seen, you know, from KFF, a recent federal survey of teen health, about 1 in 5 youth have symptoms of anxiety or depression. How do you address the mental health piece at your organization, and what are you seeing there?
Most of the kids who I talk to and their parents tell us that this is their favorite part of the week. Mm-hmm. So being at WISO, I mean, and when you walk these hallways and you sort of see what we do, you can understand why that is. So yeah, that's a big problem for young people. I have to say, when kids are here, they're hanging out with each other. We take breaks. They're hanging out at the bagel booth. You know, they're at the coffee little kiosk thing that we have over here. They're whatever, chatting. And it reminds me of like how it was when I was a teenager in the 90s. It's just like kids being kids. And then when they're in rehearsal, they're experiencing this ritual of what it means to make music in a large group, to play these great masterpieces that reach them hundreds of years after, very often hundreds of years after they were written, that still reach the minds of these teenagers. I think for a lot of these kids, like, music is an escape from a lot of the hard things in life, whether it be the stress of school or, you know, social difficulties and, you know, online stuff and all those kinds of things that kids these days need to deal with, which are in addition to the things that kids had to deal with 30 years ago. I think WISO's kind of a relief from all of that. Can we solve all those problems? No. But we don't actually see all that much of it, I think, because of the role that WISO and music more broadly plays in their lives. And quite frankly, that's like sort of that's the most important thing that we do, is we provide those kinds of that relief in their lives, that inspiration in their lives, as a counterweight to like what other things ail them.
Kyle, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
That is Kyle Knox, the music director and youth orchestra conductor at Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. He talked with us about their new facility in Madison and helping young people grow into musicians.
Weather permitting, it's the season to catch some 4th of July fireworks displays.
And I've been thinking back to a fireworks show I saw decades ago on Long Island. It was put on by the pyrotechnicians of the Grucci family. They're called America's first family of fireworks. And oh, let me tell you, the skies were unbelievable. Rob, do you have a fireworks memory that sticks with you?
Yeah, growing up, my aunt and uncle lived across the street from their local fairground where they did the fireworks show. So they always hosted a big party, and we had front row seats. We got there ahead of time, didn't have to deal with traffic either.
Nice. We want to get your take. Do you love or hate these shows? Do you do your own fireworks at home?
Let us know. Call in at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Leave a message or send a text.
Or email wisconsintoday@wpr.org and share about fireworks displays. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.